Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classic English Literature Podcast, the show that gives rhyme its reason. I hope you're all doing marvelously well. Now, today, we'll continue our look at Shakespearean drama, but the focus this time will be on how some of the Bard's plays present challenges to modern readers, modern audience members, actors, and directors. We often say, somewhat unreflectingly, that the work of Shakespeare is timeless, that it's universal. And if we mean by these that many people in many societies have enjoyed his plays for many centuries, then the sentiments are relatively uncontroversial. But if we take such plaudits literally, that his works are unaffected by historical conditions of composition, performance, and reception, and that they appeal equally to all peoples at all times, well, then we're on quite indefensible ground. It should be obvious that Shakespeare is a man of a certain class in a certain culture at a particular time. He is as much the creation of his world as he was the creator of fictional worlds. As such, while his works undoubtedly have had broad appeal across time and space, they also must necessarily reflect the cultural milieu of their composition. And the problem for some people is that Shakespeare and his cultural milieu manifest attitudes about sex, religion, and race that, compared to 21st century progressive attitudes, are insufficiently liberationist and equitable. Now, given that Shakespeare still wields enormous cultural power, some are concerned that his works can perpetuate retrogressive ideas. So, I thought it worth our time to think about this. Now, I've got to be honest, I've not really been looking forward to this episode. These issues can be quite polarizing, and they don't often lend themselves to nuanced discussion. I figured that if I do an episode about sexism and racism in Shakespeare, some will accuse me of being a woke snowflake who promotes trigger warnings and safe spaces and that cultural Marxism, which is incidentally a term that makes sense only if you are entirely unfamiliar with the work of Karl Marx. Now, if I don't do such an episode, others will accuse me of whitewashing literature and history, promoting patriarchal Eurocentric imperialism, and valorizing the work of those greatest of historical villains, dead white men. So I'm stuck between a rock and another rock. And then there's another pair of rocks, because typically in such discussions, one must decide between two extremes. Either Shakespeare is a proto-progressive who uniquely anticipated 21st century social justice tenets, or Shakespeare is a tool of white supremacy whose atavistic politics have no place in a just society. Well, since you're listening to this, you've sussed that I decided to do the episode. My purpose here is neither to valorize nor condemn the socio-political attitudes in Shakespeare's plays. This is a fool's errand in any literary analytical endeavor. And besides, since Shakespeare creates characters for the drama, thus without authorial commentary or editorializing, any line drawn between the attitudes of characters and those of the author becomes impossibly blurry. But the fact that what we may now see as chauvinistic ideas and attitudes do appear in Shakespeare's works, this forces us to deal with the gap between then and now. And it could be that Elizabethans were not as benighted as we may at first think, nor are we as enlightened as we might fancy. So, the plays I'd like to look at today are The Taming of the Shrew, from perhaps the early 1590s, The Merchant of Venice from the mid to late 1590s, maybe 96, 97, and The Tragedy of Othello, The Moor of Venice, from probably 1604. So that's two comedies, properly speaking, and one tragedy. I say properly speaking because we're used to thinking of Shakespeare's plays as belonging to three categories, right? We've talked about this, the histories, the comedies, and the tragedies. But there is an unofficial fourth group called the problem plays, and it's a term that was first used in 1896. Depending on the critic, membership in the problem play club can vary, but basically the term is used to describe a play that is structurally a comedy, but has some dark, disturbing elements more redolent of the tragic idiom. The charter members of the club are All's Well That Ends Well, Troilus and Cressida, and my personal favorite of this group, Measure for Measure. You should really read that one. It has a real resonance today in our post-hashtag MeToo moment. Two others frequently included are The Winter's Tale and the aforementioned Merchant of Venice. So I've punned on this idea with the title of today's show, The Problematic Plays, invoking that shibbolethic adjective so often on the lips of puritanical fun cancelers. So this episode will be a little different from the others. Analytically speaking, we'll be looking at today's texts in a much more limited way, focusing primarily on how they speak to our contemporary anxieties about identity politics. Now, please do remember that this is a reduction of these vastly complex plays to avatars of our own shifting political obsessions. And for those who need one of those trigger warnings, I suppose I should say that this episode will contain references to language and tropes that some may find troubling. So put your fingers in your ears and hum should you feel the need. Let's take these plays in the order of composition. So that would bring us to The Taming of the Shrew. For those not in the know, a shrew, in this sense, is a rather sexist term for a willful, spiteful, malevolent woman. Now, there's also a tiny little mammal with a pointy nose called a shrew, but the Oxford English Dictionary points out that this second meaning is virtually absent from the Anglo-Saxon to the late medieval periods, and so it proposes that the nasty woman meaning may be the original. In Shakespeare's play, the shrew, ostensibly in need of taming, is a woman from Padua called Catherine. Her demure younger sister, Bianca, entertains many suitors, but their father, Baptista, forbids Bianca to marry until ill-tempered Kate has found a mate. The suitors enlist the help of Petruchio, a boastful, materialistic Veronese on the lookout for great wads of cash. He makes a bargain with Baptista and commences to, as we would say today, gaslight Catherine until she succumbs to his authority. In a closing wager with other husbands, Petruchio proves that his wife is the most obedient and obsequious, and then they go on to consummate the marriage, tastefully, of course, offstage. That is Petruchio and Catherine, not Petruchio and the other husbands. And of course, we must also remember that in Shakespeare's day, all female roles were performed by young men. Now, this was not by any law, but simply the male-imposed theatrical convention. I hope only the most hardened of male chauvinists fail to see the deeply troubling aspects of this comedy. Now, this is not merely an old-fashioned battle of the sexes comedy a la Tracy and Hepburn. Here, women are chattel, properties to be bargained away in the marketplace. As such, we get uncomfortably analogous to horse trading, and like a fractious mare, Kate needs to be broken. In fact, the character Gremio puns upon the word courting as carting to emphasize the equine comparison. But one may say marriage in the early modern world was often a primarily financial arrangement, and that Shakespeare merely represents or even exaggerates the transactional nature of sexual relationships. And one would be right. But the way Petruchio treats Kate seems more cruel than such matrimonial attitudes would demand. He tells us, quote, "I'll attend her here and woo her with some spirit when she comes. Say that she rail, why, then I'll tell her plain she sings as sweetly as a nightingale. Say that she frown, well, I'll say she looks as clear as morning roses newly washed with dew. Say she be mute and will not speak a word, then I'll commend her volubility. And say she uttereth piercing eloquence, if she do bid me pack, I'll give her thanks. And though she bid me stay by her a week, if she deny to wed, I'll crave the day when I shall ask the banns, and when we be married." So thus he means to be confrontational and contradictory at all points, never relenting. And indeed, he does not, for he later brags, quote, "Thus have I politically begun my reign, and 'tis my hope to end successfully. My falcon now is sharp and passing empty, and till she stoop, she must not be full-gorged, for then she never looks upon her lure. Another way I have to man my haggard, to make her come and know her keeper's call, that is, to watch her, as we watch these kites that bait and beat and will not be obedient. She ate no meat today, nor none shall eat. Last night she slept not, nor tonight she shall not. As with the meat, some undeserved fault I'll find about the making of the bed. And here I'll fling the pillow, there the bolster, this way the coverlid, another way the sheets, aye. And amid this hurly I intend that all is done in reverend care of her. And, in conclusion, she shall watch all night. And if she chance to nod, I'll rail and brawl, and with the clamor keep her still awake. This is the way to kill a wife with kindness. And thus I'll curb her mad and headstrong humor. He that knows better how to tame a shrew, now let him speak, 'tis charity to shew." So he likens his treatment of his wife to the training of a hawk, and notice the verb man, meaning to command or overpower. And until she stoops to him, she'll not be allowed to eat, she won't be allowed to sleep. Starvation and sleep deprivation, and then messing up the bedroom and saying it's for her own good. He also contradicts everything she says and insists on his rightness until she breaks down, finally agreeing with her husband that the sun is the moon. She says, quote, "And God be blessed, it is the blessed sun. But sun, it is not when you say it is not. And the moon changes even as your mind. What you will have it named, even that it is, and so it shall be so for Catherine." I like the kind of the pun there. She says the moon will change even as your mind. Now, usually that's kind of a sexist attribute given to women, that they're so changeable and irrational. I like how she sticks that in there. But still, we should see this whole relationship as one of physical and emotional abuse, right? Kate is a hostage, an abductee. She's not really a wife. And then she gives a speech at the end of the play, chastising all wives who will not obey their husbands, who refuse to submit to their rule. It's really the speech that causes much of the controversy around the play today. It's kind of a long one, but you need to hear it. Here it goes. "Fie, fie, unknit that threatening, unkind brow, and dart not scornful glances from those eyes to wound thy lord, thy king, thy governor. It blots thy beauty as frosts do bite the meads, confounds thy fame as whirlwinds shake fair buds, and in no sense is meet or amiable. A woman moved is like a fountain troubled, muddy, ill-seeming, thick, bereft of beauty. And while it is so, none so dry or thirsty will deign to sip or touch one drop of it. Thy husband is thy lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign, one that cares for thee and for thy maintenance commits his body to painful labor both by sea and land, to watch the night in storms, the day in cold, whilst thou liest warm at home, secure and safe, and craves no other tribute at thy hands but love, fair looks, and true obedience. Too little payment for so great a debt. Such duty as the subject owes the prince, even such a woman oweth to her husband. And when she is froward, peevish, sullen, sour, and not obedient to his honest will, what is she but a foul, contending rebel and graceless traitor to her loving lord? I am ashamed that women are so simple to offer war where they should kneel for peace, or seek for rule, supremacy, and sway when they are bound to serve, love, and obey. Why are our bodies soft and weak and smooth, unapt to toil and trouble in the world, but that our soft conditions and our hearts should well agree with our external parts? Come, come, you froward and unable worms. My mind hath been as big as one of yours, my heart is great, my reason haply more to bandy word for word and frown for frown. But now I see our lances are but straws, our strength as weak, our weakness past compare, that seeming to be most which we indeed least are. Then veil your stomachs, for it is no boot, and place your hands below your husband's foot, in token of which duty, if he please, my hand is ready. May it do him ease. I can hear some of you saying, what? How is there any controversy about this? This is clearly the speech of a woman so psychologically battered that she has internalized the misogyny that oppresses her. This is some extreme case of Stockholm syndrome. Yeah, that is a good point. Folks like me, big fans of Shakespeare, really have a hard time with this one. It really reads like a statement of complete fealty, a total abdication of one's personhood. And with this as the culminating speech of a play that has already whipped a good deal of sexism on us, well, some folks find this difficult reading. But perhaps we're being hasty here. It's worth pointing out, after all, that none of the male characters come off particularly well. They are fools and dupes to a man. Petruchio, admittedly, somewhat rounder than the other characters, maybe roguishly fascinating in the way a narcissist can be, but I find him a difficult character to identify with or to like. And Bianca, that embodiment of male fantasies of feminine perfection, she comes off as pale and blank as her name suggests. Catherine, on the other hand, she's the only fully formed personality in the play, and her shrewishness, that may be a very, very reasonable reaction to having constantly to suffer fools. Now, furthermore, one can point out that The Taming of the Shrew as a play proper is actually a frame narrative. That is, it's a story within a story. The text opens with a scene called The Induction, in which a drunken beggar called Christopher Sly, who feels himself more noble and elevated than he is and certainly mistreats the women in this scene, while he's blacked out, he's taken up by a lord and his servants and brought to the manor house. As a practical joke, they're going to convince Sly that he himself is the lord, and that a page named Bartholomew, in drag, is his lady wife. Who shall say, quote, "What is it your honor will command, wherein your lady and your humble wife may show her duty and make known her love? And then with kind embracements, tempting kisses, and with declining head into his bosom, bid him shed tears as being overjoyed to see her noble lord restored to health, who for this 7 years hath esteemed him no better than a poor and loathsome beggar. And then he will attend a play, which is the story of Catherine and Petruchio. So the whole of The Taming of the Shrew is an exaggerated, ironic, deceptive performance of gender roles and relations, and one could easily argue that Catherine's monologue is the bookend to Bartholomew's obsequiousness, a ploy mocking Christopher Sly's pretensions and sexism. Yet, it must be admitted that to work around Catherine's final monologue, we may need to propose some extra textual leavening. The speech, as speech, is thoroughgoingly misogynistic. But how is it delivered? Unfortunately, we have no director's notes from the time, so we don't know for sure. But it doesn't seem out of the realm of possibility that Kate gives her speech with a knowing irony. Her exhortations can seem, especially to modern ears, so over the top that one questions their sincerity. Perhaps she is helping Petruchio win the bet by exaggerating their chauvinistic attitudes to absurd ends. Maybe it's meta. You know, maybe the joke here is on anyone in the audience who's dim enough to believe that, well, yes, that's the proper way for a girly to behave. Now, of course, this is all speculative. Many directors today do, in fact, take this tack, that the play ridicules misogyny rather than wallowing in it, but you almost have to do it beyond the actual words on the page. Our next play, on the other hand, contains both some very troubling anti-Semitic tropes as well as some of the most humane language in Shakespeare's canon. And they are put in the mouth of the story's putative villain. Now, that character is Shylock, a Jewish moneylender, and not, as many assume, the title character of The Merchant of Venice. Title character is a man called Antonio, a wealthy merchant whose friend Bassanio has fallen in love with Portia, an heiress in Belmont. To woo Portia, Bassanio needs some cash, but his credit is too poor to be able to raise it, so he asks his buddy Antonio to borrow the money for him. The merchant agrees and goes to Shylock to secure the loan. They strike a deal for 3,000 ducats to be repaid in 3 months. Shylock says, "If you repay me not on such a day, in such a place, such sum or sums as are benominated for an equal pound of your fair flesh, to be cut off and taken in what part of your body pleaseth me." Ho! So if Antonio defaults, Shylock can cut a pound of flesh off his body. It's a strange bargain. But it makes a bit more sense when you understand that Shakespeare's not giving us a stage Jew, a cardboard, avaricious villain like Christopher Marlowe's Barabbas in his play, The Jew of Malta, which is clearly anti-Semitic. While Shakespeare does invoke some tired stereotypes about Jews being cunning and greedy, we also find that the Christian hero of the story is rather a scumbag. Shylock complains, quote, "You call me misbeliever, a cutthroat dog, and spit upon my Jewish gabardine, and all for use of that which is mine own. Well then, it now appears you need my help. Go to then. You come to me and you say, Shylock, we would have monies. You say so, you that did void your room upon my beard, and foot me as you spurn a stranger cur over your threshold. Monies is your suit. What should I say to you? Should I not say, hath a dog money? Is it possible a cur can lend 3,000 ducats? Or shall I bend low, and in a bondman's key, with bated breath and whispering humbleness, say this: Fair sir, you spat on me on Wednesday last. You spurned me such a day, another time you called me dog. And for these courtesies I lend you thus much monies? The upright Antonio, so generous to his friends, is virulently anti-Semitic. He undercuts Jewish lending, he calls Shylock a dog and spits on him, kicks him. And responding to Shylock's question, he says, quote, I am as like to call thee so again, to spit on thee again, to spurn thee too. And I gotta say, I would want to slice this guy too, right? But would Elizabethan audiences have seen anything wrong in Antonio's behavior? Would they have respected Shylock's charges of gross mistreatment? Well, it's of course hard to say. Elizabethans actually would have had no immediate knowledge or experiences of Jews or Judaism because, well, back in 1290, King Edward I issued the Edict of Expulsion, and he banished all Jews from England to the continent and beyond. So all early modern English people knew about Jewish culture and people manifested in old tropes, caricatures, and stereotypes. So it is hard to imagine that the 16th century English soul could be fully sympathetic to Shylock's human plight. On the other hand, it seems to me that Shakespeare wants us to consider the possibility. In one of the most famous speeches in The Merchant of Venice, Shylock pleads for a recognition of his humanity. Warts and all, it must be admitted. When he hears that Antonio has been bankrupted, he swears that he'll get his pound of flesh. He says Antonio, quote, hath disgraced me and hindered me 500,000, laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated mine enemies. And what's his reason? I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions? Fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases and healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge. If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferance be by Christian example? Why, revenge. The villainy you teach me, I will execute, and it shall go hard, but I will better the instruction. This speech, rendered in prose, incidentally, Shylock's passion cannot be contained in the blank verse. It's both a soaring testament to our common humanity and a venomous charge of Christian hypocrisy. As such, the audience or the reader is put on the spot. Surely insisting on the painful death of Antonio shows a lack of compassion and mercy. But Shylock has never been shown these qualities. Is his bloody vengeance simply modeling phony Christian charity? If he's the villain, surely he has cause. The other tremendously famous speech in this play comes from Portia, Bassanio's beloved, who comes disguised as a lawyer to judge the case between Shylock and Antonio. She recognizes the literal justice of the moneylender insisting on the terms of the bond, but she urges he temper that justice with mercy. She says, quote, the quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings. It is an attribute to God himself. And earthly power doth then show likest God's when mercy seasons justice. Therefore, Jew, though justice be thy plea, consider this, that in the course of justice none of us should see salvation. We do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy. Now, doesn't that just stir the soul? An undoubtedly eloquent assertion of grace and humility in beautiful blank verse. But like many of Shakespeare's great monologues, we often remember it out of context, as if it was a freestanding poem. But situated, as this one is, in a court scene in which a powerless Jew petitions for justice from powerful Christians against a Christian, we detect that Portia's sentiments are not as universal and benevolent as we might vaguely recall. The speech asserts mercy as a godly virtue, from the God that both Christians and Jews share. But by the end of the speech, Portia makes a clean distinction between the two peoples. She says, quote, "Therefore, Jew," identifying only by his race and religion. And she goes on to say that without mercy, quote, "none of us should see salvation." The us here must be Christian only, as each faith has differing and sometimes even mutually exclusive conceptions of salvation. The type Portia invokes is based on a messianic Christology, one that Shylock obviously would not share. And then, of course, at the play's denouement, Portia, having ruled that Shylock is indeed entitled to Antonio's flesh, but not to his blood, the Christian victors show no mercy at all to the defeated and humiliated Jew. Antonio addresses the court and its judgment. Quote, "So please, my lord, the duke and all the court to quit the fine for one half of his goods. I am content, so he will let me have the other half in use to render it upon his death unto the gentleman that lately stole his daughter. Two things provided more, that for this favor he presently become a Christian. The other, that he do record a gift here in the court of all he dies possessed unto his son Lorenzo and his daughter." The merciful and unstrained court strips Shylock of his wealth, giving half to Antonio and half to the state. Furthermore, he must leave whatever else he accumulates before his death to Lorenzo, the Christian man who eloped with Shylock's daughter, Jessica. And maybe most demeaning of all, Shylock must convert to Christianity. Now, I mean no disrespect to Christianity, so save the angry emails. It's a tradition for which I have great respect, admiration, and affection. But forced conversion, especially in spiteful vengeance, is nothing but dehumanizing. The moneylender is at once stripped of property, family, patrimony, and identity. I fail to see any mercy drop-a-thing here. And I really find it difficult to imagine anyone in the audience cheering or gloating over his erasure. Maybe I have too sunny a view of human nature. I see a victim, not a villain, but one pitiable, not pitiful. And that's what makes the play a problem. See, this all happens by the first half of Act 4. There's still an act and a half left in which Shylock plays no part. Occasionally today, productions will cut Act 5 altogether. It's an awkward end, some misunderstanding about the loving couples promising rings and then giving them away under false pretenses. We're back in the realm of light romantic comedy after what I think is one of the most devastating scenes in literature. How are we supposed to read that? Is it a comedy in which the lovers overcome some melodramatic and mustache-twirling obstacles? Or does the very framework of comedy, in this case anyway, prove itself trivial and vacuous in the face of the gross inhumanity of the presumptive good guys? Some would argue, and indeed many do, that this conundrum doesn't matter. The fact that anti-Semitism is given any platform at all, even a condemnatory one, is an act of violence and oppression. Any performance of this play, however framed or staged, only perpetuates hateful attitudes and behaviors. This has become an especially acute point in recent months, given the tragic events of October in Israel, which has led to a distressing rise in anti-Jewish rhetoric and action in America and other Western nations. This seems a rather simplistic appraisal of a complex cultural text at a complex cultural moment, but it's one that increasingly finds favor. The same may be said of the final play we'll discuss today, Othello, The Moor of Venice. The tragedy concerns the elopement between the African Othello, who has been made general of the Venetian army, and Desdemona, the daughter of Venetian Senator Brabantio. The miscegenous marriage is, of course, a source of tension in the play. But the great tension involves Iago, Othello's ensign, who decides to destroy that marriage by convincing the new groom of his bride's infidelity. Iago's motive has enjoyed long contestation. Samuel Taylor Coleridge famously asserted that Iago's was a, quote, motiveless malignity. But the character himself actually gives a number of reasons for his foul machination. Anger that he was denied a promotion, suspicion that Othello slept with Iago's wife, Amelia, simple hatred. But is it racial hatred or a hatred that sometimes manifests in racist tropes? Now, maybe this is a distinction without a difference for some. The main source for Shakespeare's play is Gli Hecatomithi by Cinthio, otherwise known as Giovanni Battista Giraldi. It's a collection of tales, one of which concerns the ill-fated wedding of a Moorish captain. Shakespeare adds many of his own elements, including a threatened invasion by Ottoman Turks, but perhaps in response to a recent visit to England by, and I'm going to butcher this name, Abd el-Uhad ben Musad ben Muhammad Anun, an ambassador from Barbary which caused quite the stir of celebrity. Shakespeare elected to produce a story about infidelity with a Moorish husband. I'll put a link to that ambassador's portrait in the show notes. Many consider it the model for Shakespeare's portrayal of a Moorish nobleman. And that term Moor is quite crucial here. A Moor was, to medieval and early modern Europeans, a Muslim citizen from North Africa, the Iberian Peninsula, or Malta. Now, the term may also be applied to Turks, Arabs, and Berbers. Interestingly, Moors were not black in the way we use the term today. In early modern Europe, black, as far as skin color went, was a far more capacious category and simply meant kind of like anyone not terribly pale, like English and Scandinavians and Germans. Today, black usually refers to peoples either from or descended from the inhabitants of sub-Saharan African cultures. Shakespeare emphasizes his titular character's Moorishness by including it in the play's title, and likely envisioned his Othello as a Berber or perhaps a Turk, which gives a dramatic tension to Othello's impending war against the Turks in defense of Venice and Cyprus, as well as to his conversion from Islam to Christianity. And this is not to say that Shakespeare has an altogether unblemished record in his portrayal of Moorish characters. In his early, quite bloody tragedy, Titus Andronicus, The character Aaron the Moor's blackness is a signifier, part and parcel of his malevolence. And in the above-mentioned Merchant of Venice, one of Portia's suitors is the Prince of Morocco, a rather buffoonish character. He always strikes me as a kind of a lazy caricature of Eastern luxury, effeminacy, and decadence. And Portia's racially charged asides do indicate her distaste along those lines. Yet, when the characters refer to Othello, especially Iago, blackness becomes a source for invective. He tells Brabantio about Othello and Desdemona's elopement, quote, "Even now, very now, an old black ram is tupping your white ewe," using a black and white binary within an animalistic metaphor, barnyard metaphor. He later compounds this with a bestial image, quote, "You'll have your daughter covered with a Barbary horse." Okay, gross and crude and certainly racialized. Additionally, Rodrigo, Iago's dupe, refers to the noble general with a physiological synecdoche, calling him, quote, "thick lips." So even though Shakespeare's Moor is probably North African or perhaps Turkish, from very early on, when non-white actors began to be cast in the title role, those characters tended to have physical characteristics associated with sub-Saharan peoples. And we should remember that the earliest performances would have included white actors in heavy makeup. So the play has long been a locus, a screen for Western projections and anxieties and discussions about blackness and immigration and assimilation and miscegenation. There's quite a famous portrait of the first African-American actor to play the role, a man named Ira Aldrich, and I'll pop a link to that as well in the show notes. All of this certainly demonstrates a racial animus in Iago and his fellows. And of course, Brabantio is not pleased with Othello coming to dinner, as it were. Brabantio has a broad, xenophobic idea of his paganism and his witchery and savagery. Venetian society sees Othello as an outsider due to his dark skin, but at the same time, Othello is elevated to a very powerful and prestigious position in that society. The Duke and others respect their general. Indeed, the Duke defends Othello against charges that he senses are born of racism. Brabantio enters the council and complains that his daughter has been abducted. The Duke insists that anyone found responsible for this, even if it's his own son, will be dealt with severely. Brabantio then indicts the Moorish general with bewitching his daughter. The Duke scoffs. "To vouch this is no proof without more wider and more overt test than these thin habits and poor likelihoods of modern seeming do prefer against him." Brabantio continues his bigoted reservations against Othello as son-in-law, but under the Duke's persuasion, relents. The mixed-race marriage is accomplished and approved, and the business of state awaits. Yet, the reality of a prejudice against mixed marriages obtains in this play, and some have made the case that Othello's value to the Venetians is merely instrumental. He's good at fighting, and so they'll overlook his skin color for now. Marrying a senator's daughter, that's pushing the outside of the envelope. But if needs must. I see the value in such a reading. Such critics also point out that Othello's military prowess may be a version of the physicalizing of the black body, reducing black personhood to qualities of strength or virility or dexterity. Perhaps, can't deny it's a possibility. But Othello's also a very talented orator, despite his obviously false humility here, a great strategist, and a noble heart. He deftly moves through the corridors of status and power. Othello is no dumb jock. The biggest trip-up in this play is the fact that this noble, cultivated man eventually behaves like the savage his detractors have always insisted he was. He eventually kills Desdemona in a jealous rage after being easily and transparently duped by Iago's machinations, a deception that can be read as exploiting white attitudes about black intellect. Though the characters present at the murder scene all pretty quickly cop on that Iago is the villain, not Othello. Lodovico laments the general's betrayal and fall, quote, "Oh, thou Othello that wert once so good, fallen in the practice of a damned slave, what shall be said to thee?" So the perennial question about Othello is this. Is it a racist play, or is it a play about racists? Same thing could be said, I suppose, about the other plays we've looked at today. Is Merchant an anti-Semitic play, or a play about anti-Semites? Is The Shrew a sexist play, or a play about sexists? At the risk of defending Shakespeare, as I said earlier than I wouldn't necessarily, I tend to see him as critiquing these social injustices. But to do so, one must reveal them, and that, in itself, can be a difficult experience. Nigerian poet Ben Okri says that, quote, "It hurts to watch Othello." I can imagine that women find Taming of the Shrew painful, and that Jewish people find The Merchant of Venice painful. And while I can stand by an intellectual argument that we should continue to stage and study these plays because they force us to confront traumatic social realities, I cannot dismiss the experiences of those who live those realities. And so the question for me remains unresolved. I hope you enjoyed today's program. Thanks for your support. Thank you for listening. Please do leave a positive review if you can. Please tell your friends. And if you've got a couple of extra bucks, please click the Support the Show button. I hope you all have a great and safe and happy time until we speak again. Bye-bye.